I'm Jacob Kinberg, and you're listening to Salty Cinema. My guest today is writer-director Scott Teams. One of my favorite shows on TV in the past few years has been Rectify on the Sundance Channel. If you have not seen Rectify, stop listening to this right now and go watch the pilot. It's an amazing Southern family drama that will blow you away. Scott Teams is one of the writers and a supervising producer on that show, and also directed a few episodes. He also wrote and directed the 2009 critically acclaimed film That Evening Sun, which won the Audience Award at South by Southwest and was nominated for two Independent Spirit Awards. Here is my conversation with Scott Teams. I'm curious about what you think of the screenwriting gurus, the Sid Fields, mm-hmm. Robert McKee. Mm-hmm. Is that stuff, the rules and the concepts of screenwriting, is that something that you adhere to?
I don't adhere to it, but I certainly, I do, and hopefully subconsciously, only because... At its core, I mean, the best of that stuff is just good storytelling. I mean, I will say that I'm only really sitting here probably because of William Goldman and his books on screenwriting. What's great about Goldman is, he did it, and that's a pretty big distinction when it comes to a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
But the way he writes, and have you read like Adventures in the Screen Trader, Which Lie Did I Tell? You should read
those. I haven't
read
his. No.
They're profound and wonderful. But more than anything, he talks to you like, hey, you could do this too. And even though this is like an Oscar-winning screenwriter who's written some of the best screenplays ever written. I mean, The Princess Bride and Butch Cassidy and Marathon Man and All the President's Men. Just amazing work. He makes it seem like anybody can do this, and you just got to want it. And that was that's just the style of his writing. I mean, that's what I picked up from Goldman is his style. And I don't write anything like him, and no one does. He writes this really cut to, shot by shot by shot way of writing that comes from his early work in the 60s and 50s. But it's, and you can't do that really anymore. But it's, he writes like he's talking, like he's telling a story. He writes his books that way, and he writes his scripts that way. And Goldman was the first guy I read and who was like, hey, man, I'm going to tell you this great yarn. Like, you read his scripts, and it's like, so there's a guy, da-da-da-da-da. And you're like, whoa, and you can start seeing the story in your head. And I took a lot of that style, not maybe verbatim, but like the idea of style, right? The way that like all this guy's doing is telling me a story. And so screenwriting was sort of, it was, because you look at this sort of weird looking document that has all this sort of format to it, and it can be a little bit intimidating when you first encounter it and you don't know quite what you're doing. And I realized by reading Goldman that it was just like, hey man, here's a story. There's a guy. He kind of looks like this. He's doing this, and whoa, look at over here. And he kind of spins this yarn, and that got me very excited as a reader, but also as someone who wanted to do that. And I felt like it felt so natural and so casual in a way that I felt like I could do it too. So Goldman's books, I really took to heart. It had huge influences on me, and then reading all his scripts, which were published in several books. You know, McKee, Field, all those guys, it's like, I think it's really valuable to read that early. I read all those books, you know, when I was in school and sort of didn't read them again. Now, if you go in my house, they're on my bookshelf. Mm-hmm. I still have them. It feels like, if nothing else, sort of this sort of reminder that it's not like you're getting it. I get insecure. But of all those, I think Robert McKee's story is sort of pragmatic in a way, I guess. There's another one I read. It's called Secrets of Screenplay Structure by Linda Cowgill, I believe is her name. And, you know, it's one as I read early, because it was, and she breaks down these films. And that's interesting to me. Like, they take film, the case studies, basically.
Yeah.
And they break them down and they show you how that film works, rather than saying, this is how, this needs to happen on page 30 and this needs to happen on page 60. Mm-hmm. But yet there's value in that. You know, John Sayles puts it, John Sayles' book on filmmaking is wonderful as well. You know, he puts it, by page 30, you got to know what the game is and who the players are. As long as you do that, then you're on your way. John Sayles' book on the making of Matewan, which is called Thinking in Pictures. It's a great, great resource. One of my favorites. Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies. You know, all these, those are people who were doing it. And to me, that's a pretty big distinction, because I feel like guys probably and gals come out of here and they try to do it for a while and then they write a book because they need some money, or I don't know. I mean, that's cynical approach, a cynical point of view, but I imagine that in some cases, at least, that's what the truth is. And yeah, I mean, not that they don't have anything to say. I think they do, but it's just like that book, Writing a Script in 21 Days. Now, look, that's a, there's a lot of bad advice in that book, but there's also this great piece of advice, which is not advice, this great thing, which is like, you can do it in 21 days. You will probably have a really, really terrible script. But the first time you do it, just writing a script the first time, writing the end, is a huge accomplishment. And if you can do that once, then you can do it. And getting it to that point on page 105 or 115 or whatever it is, where you write the end, is huge. It's going to be bad. It's almost guaranteed. But just doing it is great. And so that book, for example, is one, if you stick to it and you write all those, hit those page counts that they want you to hit, in 21 days you have a script. And that's nothing to, you know, to turn your nose at. Yeah. But if you're looking at, but don't look at it as a formula. Look at it as just a tool to help you set a deadline, which is really what's important. I mean, you got to have deadlines, you got to have goals, and you have to stick to them if you want to write.
So those ideas of structure, you know, Dark Night of the Soul, and this is what
say the cat and all that stuff.
Do you think that kind of stuff probably just comes naturally because it is about just good storytelling, and that's kind of how good stories go? And so they just,
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, it certainly doesn't come natural in the sense that, like, I don't think I was, you know, just born knowing how to tell a story. I think a lot of it is watching a lot of movies. A lot of it is reading a lot of those books, and then sort of subconsciously it sort of all sinks in. But really it's just doing it over and over and over and over and over. That's how you, I mean, I wrote a bunch of scripts that were not good. And then I wrote one that was good. And that was, and that's really the only way I know to do it. And it's, I mean, I have at least 4 or 5 feature length scripts were off. But you have to go through that process until I wrote one that wasn't bad. And I was never that, one of these people that wanted to sort of try to hawk my mediocre wares across town. You know, I have children and a wife. I got to respect. I love and respect them too much to sort of like drag them out to Los Angeles and try to like sell my mediocre scripts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of, here's the thing. People say there's no good scripts in Hollywood. That's not true at all. There are thousands of good scripts, professional, you know, screenwriters out here who really, really know what they're doing. There are very few great scripts, and that's a difference. And there are really good scripts out here. I read them all the time. But most of them sort of bore me to tears because they're all trying to do the same thing. People sacrifice their own voice in the effort to sell a script. And I understand that. But I also think that well, at least in my case, the only reason I have a career now where I can actually sell stuff is because I didn't abandon my voice. Mm-hmm. Now, that means you risk, like I wrote a script about an 80-year-old Tennessee farmer. Like, that's not going to, I didn't have any illusions that that was going to sell to Universal Studios mm-hmm. for $1 million. But I knew that I cared deeply about that story. I knew that I could write it. I knew that I knew those people in that place. I knew it was a great story. A guy, old man comes back to his farm and somebody's living there. All right. It's like, okay. Either, and the guy says, I'm moving on to this little shack on the property and I'm not leaving until I get my farm back. Then there you go. He's going to get his farm back or he's not. That's a great story. It's a showdown. It's like an old, it's like a Western. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. It's about masculinity. It's about violence. It's about the South. It's about all the things that are important to me. It's existential. It's interesting. It's about what does life mean when you don't have anything beyond this world to look forward to. When you don't, what do? You grab onto whatever you have here, in this case, an old rundown house, and you grab it and you fight like hell to protect it. And what happens when you do that is you destroy it, right? That's biblical. That's right. You know, so that's like, and that's true to me. So it's true. And it's a story that was true, that I believed in, and I knew I could write really well and was compelling. And I didn't think if I was going to buy it, but I knew that I could write it really well. And then someone hopefully would say, this is great writing. Now, what would you do if you did this other thing? Now, fortunately, I also had a chance to make it, and because I also wanted to be a director. So that was an opportunity for me to make a movie that I also could make at some point because it was not very expensive. But as long as you believe in the story and you really think you can do it well and have a voice, you know, like I knew I could write it and it could have a voice, a distinct voice, I hoped that would sort of stand out from others. And because you write, trying to write for, and it's hard because I'm also a filmmaker. So it's, if you're just a writer, you need to sell your stuff. And the only way to get it sold is to make something people want to buy. And that means leaning toward a sort of poppier sort of writing, if to use like, you know, like music. It's like, so you know the difference between Justin Bieber and whatever, like, you know, some great, whatever the great, you know, the Beatles. But it's like, not that I'm writing the Beatles, I'm just saying, like, what I'm trying to say is, like, you have to, there's a sweet spot in there somewhere where you can not, you know, lose your voice, but still write something people want to buy. And that's also a challenge. But you only do it by doing it over and over and over and over. And if you're willing to do it over and over and over and over, those first five scripts that no one's going to ever read, 500 plus pages of your life, years of your life, if you're willing to do that, then maybe you have a chance to do something else.
So let's talk about That Evening Sun. Mm-hmm. So that was released in 2009, mm-hmm. right? And that was your first feature that you directed. Mm-hmm. So when did you write the script for that?
2005. It was the first script I read when I moved to California. So I was living in New York.
Okay.
So I grew up in Georgia. Went to film school. Went to a school that had a film program. Georgia State University. University of Georgia, I went for a while. They had disbanded their film program at that point. I went to Georgia State, downtown Atlanta. Got a degree in film. Graduated, got married, moved to New York. New York was sort of an easier first jump. East Coast, my family was all in Georgia. My wife's family was in Virginia and New York at the time. So we were sort of closer, you know, a lot closer to the family for newlyweds, which was a nice little jump. And also New York was just a smaller sort of, wasn't a film town. So it was, the film community there was smaller and easier to infiltrate. And we ended up forming this great, or being part of this great group called The Haven, which was a community of people of faith who were artists. So there were actors and writers and dancers and musicians and directors and all these people. It was great. And we would meet on Monday nights and have like a sort of like a church service, really, like kind of like Young Life in a way. We'd do some worship. We would you know, we'd have a little talk or something. But mostly it was about community. It was about supporting each other's work, going to each other's plays, working on each other's short films. And that was awesome because I was able to make a lot of films, short films, and work on other short films and be in a community with other people who were all kind of at the same level. Mm-hmm. It's been great because over a few year period, let's say from 03 to 07 or so, several of us sort of moved west to LA, and those of us who were sort of continuing on our journey toward a career out here, and it's been awesome. And so we're still tight out here. We still see each other all the time. There's a group of us who meets weekly, and it's been a huge part of my life. And so I moved to New York, and then I wrote a bunch of bad scripts. But I made these short films, and that was sort of like, those were getting better quicker than the scripts were.
What were you doing for money during New York?
Whatever I needed to. I sold women's shoes in Long Island City, Queens. I was a tour guide at Rockefeller Center, if you can imagine. The beard and the hair were a little shorter back then. And then I ended up, we got pregnant. My wife got pregnant, I should say, in 2002. And I got a job working at CBS as an editor. I came up as an editor as well, like you. And I edited the local news at CBS on 10th Avenue and 57th Street. And that was great because it carried me. It really provided a living wage, really. Selling women's shoes for $10 an hour wasn't going to pay my bills. But being an editor did. And my parents were happy because they were like, oh, you're doing what you want to do. I'm like, I'm not doing anything close to what I want. I'm editing the news. Yeah. But it's, you know, but it was, I might as well be working at Starbucks for like how related it is to what I want to do.
Right.
But
people think it's always like, if it's something with video, that's right. What you wanted to do. Totally. It's like,
totally. And that's okay. I understand that. But it was a great way to earn a living. And, you know, I've seen people, it's interesting because it's a real sneaky thing because it is, you're in a union, you get benefits, you get, you know, a really nice salary. And I see people get sort of succumb to that. And they might have had dreams to do something else, but they get comfortable in that life. And so what I had to do is I moved to LA. What it didn't do is it gave me a bridge. So working at CBS, they allowed me to transfer to LA. So in 2005, I had written enough bad scripts. I felt like I was getting closer to writing a good one. I hadn't written a good one yet.
Okay. Yeah. Did you feel like those scripts were bad at the time? You knew they were bad, or did you think, I think a few of these could be something? Because you had to see something in your writing that would make you want to keep writing.
That's a good question. Right? I mean, I think that I knew, I liked the ideas. I knew the execution wasn't great. Now, I think that's a huge part of this process of becoming a filmmaker is self-awareness. It's really understanding where you are on the journey of whatever, of your evolving talent, I guess. But it's, I knew they weren't great. I thought they were okay and probably thought they were better than they were at the time, but I still was aware enough to know. And here's how you become aware, all right? What you need is you have to have people around you who will be brutally honest with you. I have a cousin out here. His name is Mark Perry. He's a wonderful television writer and producer. He's been doing it here for a long time. Mark would always shoot straight with me, and I would send him my scripts, and he would tell me they were terrible in a brutally honest but kind way. Mm-hmm. He was sort of my litmus test. But also a writer's group is huge, hugely important in your development. People that are going to say to you, this is okay, or this is not good, or this is good, and you have to listen to that and be willing to listen to it. And it sucks because you get a lot of bruises that way in your ego, but that's the only way you learn. Having self-awareness is paramount. It's really you have to know where you are and where your skills are.
Even if you were able to accept that from your cousin, like this mm-hmm. script is bad, mm-hmm. you had to still think, but I'm a good writer. So even though I've written a bad script, mm-hmm. I'm a good writer.
It takes a large amount of confidence to do this, you know, and which is probably more like ego. That's why you need someone in your life who can balance that. Mm-hmm. For me, it's my wife. Someone who is, doesn't, you know, a strong woman and a dirty diaper will keep you on the path, you know, on the straight and narrow, keep you humble, right? Like having a mouth to feed. There's no, who cares if I'm saying, but this is really good if no one's buying it or no one gives a shit. Like that's the proof's in the pudding, man. Like you can think all you want that there's something you read is good, but if it's, no one cares, like it's, that's where the proof is. I felt like I was on the cusp of something that was good. And the short scripts I was writing were pretty good. And they were making these movies that were getting into festivals and they were playing. And so my problem was like idea generation. Like I was never really a great, and still not a great at sort of original ideas. I think what I like about screenwriting is, like, I love short stories because I love source material in general, but short stories in particular, because I like to say, to see like the parts of a story and then sort of like figure out how to make it a movie.
Yeah.
Or a novel's its own challenge, but short stories often can give you like a framework and allow room for you to bring some of yourself to it. That's what that Evening Sun was for me. It's this great structure, beginning, middle, and end. But then it was pretty scant in terms of character development and emotional stuff. So
how did you find that short story?
Just reading. I mean, I read a lot. That's a huge part of it. You can't write if you can't read, if you don't read. I love short fiction and I love Southern fiction. And so Flannery O'Connor is kind of my hero. And William Gay was a guy who I'd heard a lot about, but I hadn't read. And I was going to do, so in the middle of doing this editing, I also started like a video production company where I do like corporate videos and stuff. That eventually became big enough to where I could quit doing the editing and just do that, which was great because I could work for 3 weeks on a job and then I'd pay my salary for a couple of months and I can go write for a few weeks. So I was doing a job in San Jose, California. So on the way to Burbank Airport, I stopped at Barnes & Noble and I bought this book of short stories, got on the plane. First story in the book is That Evening Sun. I read it and I was like, holy cow. I got off the plane, called my friend Terrence Berry, who was a sort of young producer, and we had been wanting to do something together. I said, hey, you got to read this. He's from the South. He read it. We both, for whatever reason, whether it's ignorance or brilliance, we both said, hey, a story about a Tennessee farmer who's 80 years old, that's a great movie to make. And we both thought that was a good idea. And we went after the rights to it and got the rights. And because I needed that framework. I needed a framework that I could like bring myself to and not worry about a great ending that had a great ending and a great beginning and a great middle. Kind of a classic setup. And like five sort of key points along the way, and
is the short story set in this in a modern context, or is it kind of, you don't really know?
Sort of. I mean, it's sort of ambiguous. It may be in the 80s if it's okay. Anything. It's not that dated for sure, but it's like 20 pages. It's very short. It's just conflict, 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 conflict.
Yeah.
And what you don't really get in that story are the relationships between the old man and the young girl, the daughter, between the husband and the wife, all these things that I saw opportunity to sort of deepen these characters, because a character like Lonzo Choate, who's sort of the antagonist, in that story, he's pretty one note. He's pretty sort of typical archetypal antagonist, dumb brute, redneck, you know. So the challenge for me, and one of the challenges I take upon myself, and I think this has a lot to do with my faith, is that I want to, like, I love a character like Lonzo Choate. The greatest compliment I've ever received on that movie and could ever receive is when people come to me and they said it a few times where it's, hey, man, you know what? Like, I saw some of myself in Lonzo. And that to me is then I've achieved my goal, because what I think is one of our goals as storytellers is, what films do, the reason I love film making is because films let us experience emotion, vicariously, a range of emotion that we hopefully don't have to experience in our normal lives, especially, you know, tremendous sadness, pain, which creates empathy, like you said, empathy. Yeah. So it's the creation of empathy, and that's what great art does, because it allows you to connect to other human beings. Film does that, I think, better than most.
Yeah.
Music, I mean, storytelling, music does it as well. But in great fiction, I mean, all of it, any storytelling, but that's what storytelling has, the power it has over other, like, visual arts, is sort of that creation of empathy through story, through experiencing another's struggle. Put, walking a mile in someone's shoes, I mean, that's really what it is. And so if you, so because we like to judge people like Lonzo when we first encounter them in on a movie, in a movie and in our day-to-day lives. And I'm as guilty as anyone of that. So for me, it's like, I like to say, now how do you, the question then becomes, how do you remain true to the character who's an uneducated, brutish man who beats his wife and daughter, who's an alcoholic? Okay, how do you remain true to that guy? Don't give him the soft spot that's not there, and don't give him, don't make him more educated or a vocabulary he doesn't have. Or, and really, the question is, how do you, what's, what is an inner life look like for a guy who doesn't really have one, you know? And that's a challenge. And how I sort of, it took me a long time to get there. And for a year, for a couple of years, that script took 3 years from the time I wrote it to the time we made it. It's a long time, but in that 3 years, the script got better and better. And those 3 years ended up being the reason that the script, the movie's any good, because the script got better. If we had filmed that first script, it would have not been a good movie, because Lonzo was still not a three-dimensional character. And I couldn't figure out why. And I would write it and write it and write it. And one day, I was I put it down for a couple months. I'd come back to it. One day, I picked it up and I read my first description of him. And it said something to the effect of, you know, Lonzo steps out of his truck, blah, blah, blah. His beer belly loops over his belt, something to that effect. And then it ended with this line, a redneck if God ever created one. And I was like, I thought it was pretty, that's a pretty smart line, pretty good line. I'm pretty sassy writer. And then I read it one day and I go, I'm judging this guy as the writer.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking down upon him for the sake of a laugh. For the reader, I'm no better than anyone else in this guy's life. And he, and if the writer does not look at him with empathy, then no one else ever will. You can't. It's done. It's dead. And that's why he was not a good character. And I step back and I go, I have to look at this guy and love this guy. Love this guy. As a writer, you have to love all your characters. And I believe that. Even the worst ones. Nobody's bad for no reason. Okay. And so I stepped back and I sort of readjusted my view of Lonzo, my perspective on him, and changed that one line was sort of killing the whole enterprise, and changed it, and that changed the character. So it was a big deal.
So how, what was the process of getting it made from when you were happy with it and you were starting to show people or your
No, it's funny. I submitted it to the IFP Market in New York. It won the screenplay award at the IFP Market in 2006. I was like, done.
Here we go.
Done. Here we go. It's like, sat by my phone. Agents are going to call. Financiers are going to call. Literally no one called. And I was like, what the heck? So that was very disheartening. So then it was like, we got to just get people attached. At that point, it was still just me and Terrence. I was new to town, new to LA. I didn't have any representation. I didn't know anybody. We made a list of like 10 people, producers or production companies, entities that we thought would be good partners, people who had either made Southern films, people we or made films we really liked and that we thought was similar in an aesthetic, you know, level. People we might have someone's third cousin's nephew's dog knows this person or whatever. At the top of that list was Ray McKinnon and Walton Goggins, who I had written these parts with them in mind, but also because Ray and Walt had made these wonderful movies. They made a film called The Accountant, which is a short film that won the Oscar in 2002. They made a feature called Crystal, which I loved. I thought those two were some of the most authentic Southern films I'd ever seen. And I really wanted them because our film, I knew, was going to sort of really push the boundaries and sort of Southern stereotypes, archetypes. But it was important to the story. But I also knew I needed someone to sort of be a BS detector to kind of help me walk that line. I thought they could be great producers and they could be great actors in these roles I had written with them in mind. But we had zero connection to them. Now, here's the value of living in Los Angeles. Terrence Barry, my producer, is in Paquito Mas in Burbank, a little Mexican joint, getting a taco or whatever, and he hears this nasally voice beside him, behind him, and he's like, that sounds like Ray McKinnon. Turns around, and there's Ray McKinnon sitting in Paquito Mas. Now, Terrence, to his great credit, walks over to Ray, says, hey, man, excuse me, I'm sorry you don't know me, but I'm a huge fan of your work as a filmmaker. Now, most people only know Ray as an actor. But I'm a huge fan of your work as a filmmaker, and I got this project that I think you'd really like. Can I send it to you? And to Ray's great credit, Ray gave him his email address. Said, yeah, sure, send it. So he did. And that was in like fall 06. And Ray read it a couple months later, called and said, hey, man, I read this thing. Like, it's really good. Like, let's talk. And then, so we met. Ray was living in Arkansas at the time. He came out to LA for a meeting in October, November that year. Ray, Walt, me, and Terrence met that night. And when he came into town, and we said, let's make a movie. And then we spent the next like year and a half trying to get the money for it. And it was another year before we got Hal Holbrook.
Was getting Hal Holbrook what brought the money?
Sort of. I mean, it was. We needed an actor for sure. And, you know, it was funny. Hal was not on any of our initial lists. You know, I'd always, you know, Hal Holbrook in my mind was always the judge or the lawyer, very blue blood, you know, Mark Twain. He was sort of not, you know, I always thought about the mustache and, you know, the very stately, regal sort of way he held himself. Because those are the roles he was given. And then here comes Sean Penn, who in 2007 reimagines Hal as this sort of army man of the earth in Into the Wild. And we all saw that movie, that fall of 07, and we were like, that's the guy. Holy cow. And another good, like, sort of connection, just like, you know, Walt's former agent was Hal's current agent. So we were able to call over there and say, look, we don't have any money, but we have this role, which we're pretty sure you don't get, which is a lead role for an 80-year-old. It doesn't come along very often. So we sent it over there. He read it, and he came on board. And then that coincided with Laura Smith, another producer on the film, meeting up with an old friend of hers just for drinks, who had taken a new job working for a production company out of Tennessee, who just as he was leaving their drinks meeting, he just said, hey, by the way, this is kind of crazy, but if you happen to have any movies that take place in Tennessee, I'd love to see it. She's like, I happen to have one, as a matter of fact. They were looking for a John Grisham-esque courtroom thriller. And she said, well, this is not exactly that, but there's a lawyer in it, if that works. And he's like, sure, send it over. And so she sent it over. And just they had wanted to make a film in Tennessee with Tennessee money. You can't plan that. Yeah. You can't, I don't know. And if that didn't happen, if they hadn't met for drinks that night, would I be sitting here? Probably. I mean, who knows? Because you just don't know. And it's so many of these little things. I mean, you absolutely don't have to live in L.A. to have a career these days. But it's a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And you miss the opportunity for those little things to happen like that. Once you get, you know, once you're down the road, maybe it's a lot easier. But I live in Austin or Nashville or places where things are happening. But it's trickier, you know. That's the truth.
Yeah. So you, at first, weren't thinking that you would get to direct it, though. You had written it, or did you always?
No. Yeah, I wrote it for myself, and they actually someone tried to buy it from me about a year earlier. Someone tried to buy it to direct themselves. I didn't do it, which is hard because I needed that whatever they were offering me, $25,000 or something like that. I mean, it was not much, relatively speaking, but it's for me back then it was a lot, and I could have used it, but I believed in it too much. I knew it was good. Again, that was like proof that it was good. Like someone wanted to buy it. I knew the story was good. It validated that. And as long as we kept getting validation, our whole motto is this. Again, going back to that, I don't want to be a guy out trying to sell you my crap. But people, it kept winning awards. People kept saying, we'd send it to like all the people we knew who were producers or financiers or whatever. And they'd say, love it. Not going to make it. Yeah. I'll be the first one in line. Can't make it. Yeah, because of the, it's an 80-year-old guy, blah, blah, blah. But everyone loved the script. It was just an issue of, you know, but what they were willing to do.
Did you insisting on directing it, not having had anything before, hurt in terms of trying to find the money? Or did you think that that might be?
No. When we finally found the people, they wanted to know, you know, how I knew that I could direct it. And that's when my short films came into play. And in that time, actually, I had made a short film called A Death in the Woods, which was based on a different William Gay short story. So I wanted to make a movie that was in the same vein, same sort of feel, same world, but not just a scene from my movie. I wanted to be its own standalone thing. So I optioned a different story from that same short story collection. And went and I raised some money through friends and family, through fiscal sponsorship, went down to Florida and Orlando and shot this movie down there in 3 days and got some good festival play. And that's where I met Barry Corbin, who was in that movie, who later in The Evening Sun. So it was great. And then I showed him that movie and they were like, okay, he can direct that small little 10-minute movie. And that's when short films come in handy. They're absolutely vital and necessary. There's a different sort of thing now with sort of digital filmmaking. Anyone can do it. And there's a mess of short films out in the world, but most of them aren't very good because people aren't spending any money anymore because they don't have to. They have these little cameras that do everything for them. But if you can, you got to show that you can hire a crew, work with a crew. I mean, for me, I looked at short films as a test run, not just proving that finished product as proof that I can do it, but also for me as a filmmaker, I want to know what it's going to feel like when I walk on set the first day. And if you're out making a movie on your little DSLR camera with three buddies, that's great to get your craft down in terms of your eye down and your sort of your aesthetic taste down, but you also need to know what it means to work with a crew. So I would raise money, and so the first short film I made was this little, I made $7,000, had a crew of like eight, and then I made that, raised a little more money, made a movie for $20,000, had a crew of 25 or something. Then we raised like $40,000, made Death in the Woods with a crew of 50. You know, just, you know, and so you have to just sort of do a dry run and see what it, and understand what it feels like to be on a set, because you don't want to be overwhelmed with that kind of, those details when you finally get your shot. So for me, it was really a process, not just of making the movie, but also of making the movie, of being on set. And the actual process was important.
So the film, what kind of a release did it get in 2009?
We did like, we debuted at South by Southwest. It was our premiere, and we won the two awards there. Did a whole, about a year on the festival circuit, or about maybe like 8-9 months. And came out, did New York and L.A. in November. Then we just did this sort of like, we had like only had three or, we know we had maybe, no, we had, I think we had 8 or 9, 10 prints of the film. Film prints. Wow. That's how long ago this was. We had these film prints. No DS, no, what do you call it? What's the... Daggum, you know. No, we had film prints, and And we would just send them. We could only book the film in as many theaters as we had prints. Mm-hmm. So we'd play three cities for a week, and then we'd play. So the film ended up playing 75 markets theatrically, which is, we had no expectation of that. But it just kept going. People would just keep requesting it. It'd play calendar houses, it'd play art houses for a week. But it made a little bit of money. I mean, it made a few hundred thousand dollars. But for our little film we self-released, that's pretty big. And it was in theaters for like 9 months or something. Wow. Just 1 week at a time. And just go to the next one. People would hear about it, get good reviews, blah, blah, blah. Got a couple of Independent Spirit nominations. So it was a great run. Got me an agent, manager, all that stuff. It did the work that I was hoping it would do. Yeah. It certainly didn't make any money for me. I mean, you make a movie for $1 million, you know, I spent 5 years of my life on that movie. I made a sum total, I think, of $20,000. $10,000 for the script, $10,000 to direct it. Now, you know, that'll last you about 5 days in New York, in LA, or 5 weeks in LA, not 5 years. So yeah. You got to find other ways to do it. But you make your first movie to make a movie. And then you hopefully parlay that into something beyond that.
Did you feel like it was, after watching it, I felt like it was just a great calling card mm-hmm. film for what I would assume are the type of films that you want to continue to make.
Yeah.
Did you look at it that way? Like,
yeah,
this is
for
what,
sure.
This is me.
Like, yeah, yeah. I felt very confident. Still do. Like, even a few years later, I can go, well, that's what I do. And this script's going to feel like that. Now, I've written other things, and that opened the door for a writing career. So for me, basically, I sort of look at it, the films I've only made that one feature. I've made a feature documentary, and then I've directed television. But so I'm still looking to make my next narrative feature. But because, you know, it's hard to make these movies that are $4 or $5 million. It's a really hard thing right now. Mm-hmm. So, but I still, whether it's, you know, when I'm trying to put a movie together and sending it to actors, or, you know, whatever it is, I can, that's the movie that aesthetically feels like a lot of what I want to make myself. Then I write other things, bigger things. So I sort of determined to forge a career as a writer to support my family. Mm-hmm. So I started doing that, and I've written things. So I write things now for other directors, bigger projects, you know, more commercial projects, and that's been a real blessing to be able to kind of get my toe in the door there and do that. And then we're in television has been really the boon for me. And again, that's relationships. Mm-hmm. So a few years go by, Ray McKinnon makes Rectify. I watched the first season as a friend and a fan. Mm-hmm. You know, he loses his three writers from the first season. And then he calls me one day. Now, I had been looking to get into television, unbeknownst to him, but I just didn't know how to get into it. And it's hard to get into TV as a writer. I'd never written any television scripts before. But Ray calls me kind of out of the blue and says, hey, would you come work on Rectify? Because we had worked on That Evening Sun together. And so, and Rectify is a similar voice, similar, yeah. You know, it's George's show and blah, blah, blah. So again, it's relationships. So I was able to sort of bypass the traditional TV route, which is you start off as a writer's assistant and you sit there and type up notes all day. It's a very difficult job. I don't, you know, I'm very fortunate that I didn't have to do that. I kind of came in at this, you know, as a writer producer, and that was a huge, you know, blessing. And, because Ray, you know, trusted me and gave me a lot of autonomy and from the beginning. And so that was huge because, I mean, people work their whole lives trying to work on a show that's they think is great. And I was able to do it from the beginning, work on a show that I believed in, that I thought was truly art, and that had something to say about the human condition. And where I also had a real voice, and I could direct the show and write the show, and it's been a real blessing.
Yeah, Rectify is one of my favorite things that's ever been on television. It's so awesome. There's nothing else
yeah.
that's like it. did you, I mean, in watching that first season, were you just kind of blown away? Not even like, I mean, knowing that you were friends with
I'd read the script a few years prior, and because, you know, it took a long time to get it made. And so I knew the script, but even then, seeing it, it was just you know, it's really fun to see your friends get to succeed, you know, and to get to do what they want to do. And Raid worked so hard on that, and you know, and to see him succeed, and for me going back to work on it, you know, Ray was, his belief in me, he was the first guy of any real accomplishment to believe in me. And his support of That Evening Sun, and along with Walton as well, but Ray's support of That Evening Sun really is what gave me a career. And he's given me a career twice. He's given me a film career. He's given me a TV career. So for me, it was an opportunity to pay back all that great kindness that he had shown to me. And he would, if he was sitting here, he would laugh and say he was only doing it for his own self-interest. But it's true. Like, he gave me opportunities, and he supported me and believed in me. So it was an honor to work on Rectify and to sort of pay that back.
How much of Rectify did he have of the story from the beginning?
First season.
Just the first season. It. So when you came in, you guys like are
clean slate.
Just trying to figure out what where's it going now.
It was challenging, you know. It was very difficult, but really fun. I mean, you sit in a room. Now, I don't know whose idea the writer's room was originally, but whoever had the idea to put, you know, a bunch of introverts in a room together and have them talk all day long, it's like hell. But some days it's fun, but most days it's really exhausting. For me, it's really hard. Like, after this interview, I'll go take a nap because it's just, I get exhausted.
Yeah.
I like talking. I mean, I enjoy it, but it just exhausts me. So a writer's room is very difficult, taxing. Do this every day, all day, for months. But in that situation, we really didn't know. We had just, let's just go. And he was very open, and you know, and he kind of just trusts his own, you know, meter, his own barometer for what's true. And if it doesn't feel true or real to him, he can't do it. He can't write it. So we would just talk, ideas. You know, most writers' rooms, you sit around and they're talking about, like, okay, this next thing happens and this happens and this happens. We sit around for 4 hours and talk about what it must mean to not have a mother. I mean, it's just, you know, we have these really philosophical, existential conversations every day. And it's like all the time. That's our... And we eventually get to the point of actual story stuff.
Yeah.
It comes after a long time of talking about life, which is interesting.
Was that a show where the writers were bringing in a lot of things from their lives that were...
No, not specifically. Not like episodes or anything like that. But it's, you can't help but bring yourself. Yeah. What I liked about Rectify is there's... Because a lot of it's philosophical, theological... but in that room at various times you have a lapsed Catholic, a secular humanist, a non-practicing Jew, you have a devout Christian, you have a stone cold atheist. That's our writer's room. And I love that because you have different points of view and we're forced to listen to each other. And because it's a balance across the board, like, there's like not really any predominant belief system. Like, you can't have the arrogance or ego to think that you're always right, or your point of view is right. And it's a sort of lovely. Now, we argue a lot, and but when it's at its best, it forced me into listening to other people. I've really been trying to do that as in my life in general, but then God knows, especially the last however months of this election cycle, trying to listen, because I don't always do that, and I get my mind made up, And I rectify writer's room allowed me to really listen to people who didn't think the way I thought. And I don't always do a great job of that, but when it's forced upon you, I think it's only positive for your development as a human being.
So I know you can't speak for Christian artists in general, but for yourself, do you have a mandate or a mission of what you feel like God, how, what the best way for me to use the gifts you've given me mm-hmm. is this, and I'm going to try and pursue mm-hmm. this way of working in this industry.
Well, I mean, no, because the best way, the only way I know how is just every day. And I say I do this every day, and some days I actually do this. I want to do this every day. It's just to wake up and just open my hands, man. Like, mm-hmm. I do not, as soon as you just say, like, I can, man, the number of people who have come out here to LA or who came to New York, people that came to New York after 9/11, for example, where we were there. God's called me here and I'm going to change the world. I'm going to heal these broken people. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll check with you in a year. See if you're still here, which most of you won't be. Mm-hmm. And how's that going for you? And same thing out here. As soon as you determine that God has called you to something and you say, this is my calling and that's it, then you're dead. You're dead mm-hmm. in the water, man, because you've removed God from the process. Mm-hmm. You've removed God from the equation. I would never dare to say God has told me to do something. I don't know. I think that's very, very, that's tricky business. And at least I don't trust myself to say no. So for me, all I can do on my best days is just open up my hands and say, you know what? I don't know what the life looks like for me, but I know that right now, this is what I love. This is what I care about. This is what I want to do. This is what I feel like I want to do. But what I want to do more than anything is just to do what will best serve people and your purposes in this world, mm-hmm. God, which I believe is about loving people. So you give me a passion for the filmmaking community and the art of filmmaking. And today, that's what I want to try to do. Change my heart, if that should be doing something else. Mm-hmm. Give me a passion and some other passion. Help me not drive my family into the ground through some obsession that I have, mm-hmm. which is hard to do, man. To know the balance, know the difference. Because we want it. Because so much about the problem is, and Ingmar Bergman said this, you know, he's like, I'm going to mess up the quote now, of course, now that I brought his name up. And art lost its power when it was divorced from worship. Hmm. When we assigned a name to the work of art, that's when art began to lose its power. Because as soon as we did, because art used to be anonymous. Hmm. And made in the praise of God, mm-hmm. we began to assign authorship to art, and then it became about the author, right? The creator, the earthly creator, the person. When it becomes about the person, then it becomes about praise. It becomes about we are humans. We are addicted to praise. It's a drug. Mm-hmm. And then the art devolves from there. Because imagine a world in which no one ever knew what you did. All you would want to do is the best stuff. You wouldn't want to do anything that compromised glory, mm-hmm. beauty. It wouldn't matter. It would like only be to the beauty of God. But because we get praise, personal praise, and therefore money and gain from that, like we are humans. I'm a human. I'm corrupted by that. Very corruptible in that regard. And so I just feel like we have to just walk through with as open hands as we can and every day be willing to change, be willing to do something different and not determine that we must accomplish this in our lives or we'll be failures, because that's not true.
Do you think there's anything particular about being a Christian that hinders the ability to make good art?
fear. I never met a more fearful group of people than Christians. Ironic. The most ironic thing in the world.
Yeah, we shouldn't.
I think this election has proven that to me. So, you know, it's like you're in the fear in the day to day of filmmaking is that, we're afraid if we don't say the name of Jesus, then it's not Christian. We're afraid if we don't, if someone doesn't get saved by the end of the movie, then it's not a Christian movie. And that's just not true. In fact, often it's the opposite. Often when you do that stuff, you create a piece of, not art, you create a piece of propaganda. You create something that doesn't challenge anyone. It just gives them answers for questions they are not asking. Our job as Christian storytellers is to ask the questions and to get people to recognize there are questions to be asked. A great quote that I do not know the source of is that the problem with a lot of Christian writers is they want to give the answers before they've asked the questions, you know, and that's to badly paraphrase that. Before they've asked the questions. Yeah. So it's like we're way ahead of ourselves, man. We are not, because if we don't do it, oh my God, who's going to tell them? Like the truth does not matter to anyone, you or me or anyone else, unless we discover it for ourselves. I can tell you till I'm blue in the face that Jesus is the Son of God. And until you have a personal experience with that truth, it will mean nothing to you. Mm-hmm. Nothing. We have to help lead people to encounters with God. If God is real, and we don't do it by telling them that, we do it by giving them experience, right? We do it by asking questions, by probing the meaning of life, by saying that sometimes things happen we can't explain, by saying, is that fair? Is that true? Is that just? I don't know. But there are questions to be asked. The simple idea that there are questions to be asked, that is worthy of exploration. Mm-hmm. Like, some people don't even go there. Like, there's nothing beyond this world to many, many people, many, many very, very, very intelligent, very thoughtful people. And simply engaging them on a level of being willing to ask questions, being willing to acknowledge that there are things perhaps that our finite brains can't comprehend, that alone is worthy. And like That Evening Sun, for example, I'll go to the mat all day long and say that's a Christian film. There's Jesus is never mentioned except through, you know, cursing. Mm-hmm. And this, but yet, like I said, what it's about at its core, it's about a worldview. It's about that, you know, when you don't see anything beyond the horizon, there's nothing to look forward to in this. This is a man at the end of his life who has nothing to look forward to. So what does he do? Is he fights like, grabs on what he has and he fights like hell to control it, and he destroys it. He puts the thing before the person, and that's what kills him and destroys everything. And that's a worldview that I believe in. That's why I can tell that story with conviction, right? And but it has, and that's far more to me, more truthful and honest than a lot of quote unquote Christian movies that want to say, like, give your life to Christ and you get a new truck or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever is that sort of beyond, it's even putting aside the aesthetic qualities of a movie and the writing of it, which, in, you know, like, our job, again, we are called, if you want to be called to anything, it's called to being excellent as an artist, to being excellent as a craftsman, whether you're making movies or making tables or whatever. We have to make the best tables, and people forget that. They skip over the part of being the best at something in order to tell, it's to give us a message, which no one's going to care to hear if your story's crap. So, you know,
say that you did want to tell a story where someone comes to Christ.
Right.
Is there a way to do that well, or is it just by the nature of even telling that story, you're going to make a movie that is going to exist over here and only certain people can watch it?
I don't know, man. I honestly don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, it's, I would say this. Here's the thing. If coming to faith in Christ is the point of the movie, that's different. A character having a faith experience is one thing. In the experience of a story as a whole. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there's examples of, like, you ever seen Odette, like Dreyer's film, like people, like there are faith experiences in movies that can be radical and can be amazing. Tarkovsky, I mean, there's mystical experiences. There are unexplainable experiences that are God moments in many, many movies that I love deeply and dearly, and that I think would probably qualify in a more sort of obtuse way or less direct way, I guess. If the some point of your movie is for some person to like receive Jesus and their life is better and done, and because here's the problem: when too often that becomes a for Christians, we think that are the stories we tell, like when we accept Christ in our lives, like our journey's over. Like the problem is when that becomes the answer. Like it's finished. Hey, it's done. Like, and life's gonna be better. Okay, now. That's like the happy ending, is you accepted Christ. Well, that's not true, first of all, and not true to life experience, because all that an audience will relate to is life experience, and only they will relate to what they can relate to. And if you want to use that as some kind of tool to convert, if you're showing it exclusively to an audience of Christians and you want to have someone have a Christian conversion, that's okay. But you're never going to control your audience that way. But B, like, you can comment on that because it's your audience that exclusively understands that experience. But if you want to, I mean, look, I don't want to speak in absolutes. Like, of course, there's like maybe. I don't know. I can't think of any off the top of my head that I care anything about.
Yeah.
But I also haven't seen everything, so you know, I don't want to judge that.
The reason that it's a question for me is because I think testimonies are some of the most powerful stories that I've heard that influence my faith, is hearing about how someone else came to Christ.
Yeah.
There's so many great stories of people coming to Christ. And I'm curious, because I agree with you that usually if that's what the story is, it doesn't work. And I'm just wondering, like, these stories impact me. So there has to be a way for them to work, for them to be told in a movie that it could impact other people.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge, I think, becomes, and maybe there is, I mean, the challenge becomes as soon as you assign a specific end goal to it, meaning like the end goal of this is faith in Jesus Christ, then anyone who doesn't have faith in Jesus Christ is going to be skeptical of this. Now, again, but a great testimony cuts through that. Now, the difference is I understand. Like I'm said, I've been in churches and groups and meetings where people have given testimonies where I'm like, wow, that's really remarkable. I'm touched by that. And you would think it'd be a pretty simple translation from one to the next. Yeah. For whatever reason, I just get queasy, man. Like, it just doesn't work. Yeah. Now that it can't work. It doesn't work for me. Now, it doesn't mean it won't work for somebody else. And if $5 million is spent on a movie and one person comes to Christ, then I have to believe that that's a good thing. Now, I will also say same token, it's like, and if in that case 50 million people are turned off because of the crap that is, is that really worth that one? I mean, who knows? Of course it is. But it's like, I mean, you know, I'm just saying it's.
Yeah.
But I'm also pessimistic about that. I'm also probably jealous. I'm also probably like people that I think are inferior filmmakers are getting to make their movies and are getting this free check from the Christian community who has no aesthetic sort of taste and quality. You know, it's like, I just feel like.
And there's no part of you that thinks if they gave me that money, I could do that well and make good things for sure. That.
Of course I do, but they would never want to see them. You know, it's like, I mean, they, it's hard because, you know, I feel disconnected to a lot of the people who, you know, I mean, and good. I mean, there's billions of Christians in the world. I mean, it's like, come on. I mean, so it's, we're obviously going to be very, very sort of, you know, disparate in our sort of likings and our, yeah, our interests and our tastes. And I just don't know ultimately how, I mean, like, we have a lot of work to do just to love people well. Mm-hmm. Start there. When you get that figured out, then start caring about, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Gay marriage. And I mean, like, start there, dude. Start with loving people well. Mm-hmm. Then worry about the things that don't really matter in the grand scheme of things. Like, because we're not, I mean, the divide right now in the United States especially, I mean, it's just, and it's so caused often by Christians who I'm sure have the best interest in their heart, but they are fearful of anyone's opinion but their own taking root. Like, and let's go ask, you know, go ask the Europe how it was like when the state adopted all the Christian tenets and forced them upon people. How'd that work out for Christianity? Mm-hmm. As a whole in Europe, not well, right? So there's a lot of dark times.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to just be careful. I didn't want to get political in this.
No,
and feel free to edit that out, but it's like I don't it's not necessary. I don't want to cause more division than already is there, but I also feel like someone has to stand up for art. And I'm not suggesting that I make great art. I'm just saying that I desire to, and that that works better in the long run at changing a heart.
Yeah.
Than propaganda.
Yeah.
So.
So. In your view, how would you define the difference between? Because no matter what, when you make a film, you have something that you're trying to get across,
sure,
right? So how would you talk about the difference between propaganda and art? When does it cross that line?
When your objective, and only your deepest heart knows this, right? Like, are you trying to make a point, or are you trying to connect? Are you trying to sell me something, whether literally or figuratively, or are you trying to connect to the human race? I'm trying to meet you where you are. I'm trying to get you to meet me where I am. That's really the question, I think.
Okay.
I'll meet you where you are and say to you, I empathize with you. I empathize with life. Here's a place where I think our stories connect at this level.
Hmm.
I've written several scripts about the struggle of faith. They're very explicitly about faith. But there's the answer is that I don't know all the time. And the answer is that life is full of pain. And that's just life. And you can find a joy inside of that sometimes, but that's not really a lot of my stuff. Most of my stuff is just about the foibles of man. And like, here's the thing. I've never written a happy ending that I know of. And I think because if we as humans are capable of happy endings, why do we need a savior? I think that's why I approach it that way. My films tend to end on down notes because that is man's experience when man leaves it up to himself. Man left alone man is not inherently good. That's my personal opinion. So to say he is, I think, is not true. And he has good in him. I'm saying a lot of things I probably will regret one day. But it's like, I feel like left to his own devices, man is destructive. And it's like the absence of a savior, to me, that highlights the need for one.
Right.
I think is what I'm trying to get at.
That make that evident to people who don't have Christ are going to make them think, I can't do it. If I can't do it, I don't know what am I going to do?
Is there someone who can? And if I can get somebody interested in, if I can get someone interested in even asking that question, then I've done my job, I think. I don't have to save the world. I just have to get people asking questions. And I think that's the power of art, because it can connect to you on some level that you can't articulate, but it can make you ask questions.